Okay, thanks. It's always great to be at the KITP. Okay, so I'm going to give a much more sort of a survey in the beginning of my talk than many very interesting, talks specifically developing particular strain compactifications. I'm going to try to ask a few of the questions that, I think we all think about, but tend not to ask, in part because we don't have any very good results to announce, but they're still important. And I'll kind of segue from that into talking about recent work about effective potentials and non-supersymmetric vacua. Okay, so we have this list of requirements for the quasi-realistic compactification that could describe our world. And by quasi, I mean basically, it could be realistic, but our calculational ability is kind of not quite up to it. It's definitely in that class that we should be looking at. And they range from particle physics down to GR and cosmology constraints. And I think it's very impressive how much progress has been made. Certainly, 10 years ago, people talked about calculating Yukawa textures or couplings, but it was pretty vague, and now people do it. And there's a really wide variety of scenarios for beyond the standard model physics. But of course, from some top-down point of view, there's an equally striking fact, which is that if you take a string compactification at random, it almost certainly will have nothing to do with our world. Because even if you put four dimensions and you put various of the criteria on that list, and so if you we're looking for something to be disappointed about, then you might point out that, well, in fact, there seems to be very little correlation between the things you need to do to solve the various problems on the list. You certainly might have hoped that fixing the moduli or solving some particular problem would bear directly on the standard model, and the way that the hierarchy problem suggests supersymmetry, you could get other insights into beyond the standard model. And so far, string theory produces this large and interesting menu of possibilities. There are lots of other things, of course, that wouldn't fit with string theory. Again, we don't talk about them in conferences like this, but it's very important to stress that if you made some, again, random list of possible LHC discoveries, by far, the detail, when you measure the details, most of them would not fit with string theory or even with, field theory, particle physics as we understand it. So there's certainly a lot of, again, no reason, I think, to be worried about the prospects for contact with data, but nevertheless, this is, I think, the case. And certainly from the point of view of the data we have to hand, and we should, again, it's one of the most obvious questions, I think, that stares us all in the face. And so we have the more kind of philosophical question, and of course we have the more kind of scientific question. Well, there's all this information in the string theory, and if we just focus very narrowly on reproducing the standard model, enumerating the possible predictions, somehow we are missing 99% of the data in this particular area, and there must be something good we can do with it. And of course there are various, what you think is the the approach depends on how you think this kind of issue might be resolved. So it's conceivable that although it looks like we have a lot of realistic things, in fact we don't. This used to be a much more prevalent idea before we realized the number and scope of possibilities. Could be, of course, that there really is things we're missing, some big class of compactifications which all look much more realistic, and that's really where we should be looking. Could be, of course, that they're not all equivalent from the point of view of early cosmology and the dynamics that led to our universe. Of course, then there's the anthropic explanation. And what makes the thing hard to think about is that this surely has truth to it, too. It's clear that most of the vacua are not viable in whatever sense of the word you mean anthropic. And so you can't just say you don't like that and leave it out. Okay, but in any case, these are, to some extent, they bear on science, but you can also take it as just philosophy. But of course, then you have problems as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I tried to start the discussion that way by saying that as a, you know, generator of these mechanisms of testable ideas, string theory has proved very rich, and I think very successful. But as a kind of hard-nosed, you know, predictor, you know, which is a standard applied in much of the rest of science, you know, then. Yeah, it's a reasonable attitude to say that, you know, there's a lot of structure predicted here that, that we, you know, don't expect to test, and, you know, it's not a weakness of string theory that it depends so much on this high-scale physics, but nevertheless, if you just restrict attention to gauge group and low-energy physics, it's still the case, the thing we're saying. So, I wanted to throw out questions which I think should be mentioned at every workshop like this, you know, and I don't expect them to... They provoke debate, you know, and one should think about them. Okay, so anyways, I think one of the best questions as far as this question, well, you know, what do we do with all this, you know, 99.99% of the other stuff, is that, we have a great deal of experience in finding that the answers, not necessarily to the first question we asked, but to the version of the question that string theory tries to answer, are much simpler than we would have hoped. And so it could be that this set of all the string vacua is really much simpler than these pieces that we've been looking at, you know, or even in the standard model, if somehow, you know, properly looked at. Okay, and so that's certainly a worthy, idea to explore. And, you know, it's not terribly clear. I think the only case where you could really, you know, strongly maintain this are the maximally supersymmetric, both, you know, gravity and Yang-Mills cases. And their supersymmetry is incredibly constraining. Moduli spaces have to be homogeneous spaces. There are a lot of internal conditions, you know, modular invariants in the heterotic string and the other strings and so forth, analogs in the other strings. And you can make, I'm not sure, you know, perhaps somebody can tell me a reference where the conjecture is really spelled out, at least in the light of present knowledge. But I think the data is there to make a kind of plausible conjecture for, you know, everything with these supercharges, you know, some simple description of it. Okay, and so how, you know, besides, you know, having tried to construct things and come up with this list and failed to construct more, you can actually do much better in this case because, first of all, the original theories are incredibly constrained. And then when you compactify, we're talking about so much supersymmetry that you've got moduli that basically allow you to recover the large volume limit. So from the lower dimensional point of view, you get these towers of BPS states that really do fill out Kaluza-Klein modes and must be there on general grounds. And so you can be pretty confident. And that, again, I think that kind of argument could be, you know, made pretty solid at this point. Okay, so then you move down to 8 supercharges, and now that's less constraining. Obviously, you want to work in the highest dimension you can, and I think the main topic of Wadi's following talk is going to be this case of F-theory compactification down to 6 dimensions, because what was found starting in the late, you know, 90s was that anomaly cancellation is extremely powerful in 6 dimensions. And the basic difference between these dimensions like 2, 6, and 10, where it's very powerful, and 4 in particular, is that the anomaly polynomials, so just as in 4 dimensions you have these, you know, cubic combinations of the charges that have to cancel, you know, it's dimension over 2 plus 1, so in 6 it's a quartic function of charges. And so that carries a positivity. You know, you take q to the fourth and that's necessarily non-negative. And so you can try to arrange things so that a bunch of things enter with the same sign, and then that's a highly constrained problem. You know, sums of positive things, quantized, you know, numbers adding up, you know, to a certain number has a finite number of solutions. So it's a highly constrained problem. Now the actual problem of F-theory in 6 dimensions is quite a bit, you know, or just general constraints in 6 dimensions is quite a bit more subtle, because this is one of the basic anomaly conditions. Again, you know, why, I'm sure why we'll spend much more time on this, is it's not quite positive definite. You know, obviously, you can mass up a hyper and a vector by the Higgs mechanism, and so it's not. But the combination of anomalies and constraints is quite constraining. And then this, to some extent, corresponds to a mathematically nice and already proven statement that properly defined, there's a finite number of the elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau threefolds that you would use to you know, make F-theory compactifications. I'm sure Wadi will go into the conjectures that come out of this kind of work. And in particular, you can, I think, quite reasonably conjecture that all these 5 plus 1 supergravity matter theories with 8 supercharges come from string and M-theory compactifications. So that could be, and very interesting. As I said, you know, to the extent, I mean, in itself, that doesn't necessarily make the description simple. Of course, if the low energy constraints are simple, then the description is simple. That's about as simple as we can hope for things to get. Now, I think the problem with this as things stand, or the, you know, opportunity for somebody, is that it really relies on these special properties of 5 plus 1 and the fact that anomalies are so constraining there. And people have thought for quite a while about the consequences of anomaly cancellation in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And again, you know, it's rich. You know, there's the Tufts consistency conditions. There's many constraints on the theory, but it's not that hard to build up huge classes of theories. Again, because there's no real positivity. You can just start adding sectors at will, and you rapidly run beyond the things for which there's any evidence in string theory. So, you know, at least in the naive, from the consistency conditions that we know, it's hard to you know, see how these things are going to match up. Now, it seems clear that one of the main missing ingredients.
Should you expect that any consistent 3 plus 1 theory comes Higgsing a 5 plus 1 theory?
Well, it's not Higgsing. It's a much stronger relation. You can compactify 5 plus 1, but no, there's no reason at all to think that all the 3 plus 1s could be lifted up to 5 plus 1. And here the amount of supersymmetry is different than the case. We're asking for 4 supercharges in the standard discussion. So so it's not, again, it's probably a useful idea, but not obviously the killer idea. And you know, one of the key missing ingredients is the analog of this 5 plus 1 equation I quoted that puts some sort of a priori count on the number, total number of degrees of freedom. And again, this is a famous problem in 3 plus 1. You know, what's the species bound? You know, is there some limit on the number of fields you can have in a theory of quantum gravity? Because this bears very directly on questions like, is there a bound on the total entropy in some region? You know, comparing the region of, you know, a black hole with, you know, some vacuum region. So people have thought about this a lot and more or less banged their heads. I mean, it could well be that there's some brilliant argument waiting to be made, but we don't have it yet. Well, that's right. It's very easy to construct cases where it seems like you get very large numbers of degrees of freedom. Now, I'm going to come to that one actually shortly, because the essential difference which I will draw, and I think you have also drawn, is if you're classifying vacuum of time-independent things versus time-dependent things. Yeah. So, yeah, definitely you can make constructions with lots of degrees of freedom. Okay, so let me be a little bit more specific and talk about M-theory on the Calabi-Yau threefolds and go down to a 4 plus 1. So now we're still in the 8 supercharge realm. And on the other hand, we just have hypers and vectors. Okay, and then in this Calabi-Yau compactification, they have simple geometric origins. We can put the three form on a 2 cycle and get a vector. We can put it on a 3 cycle, get a hyper. So here's some data of the low energy theory with a direct topological interpretation. So this is, of course, the famous old Candelas et al. Plot of Euler character on one axis and B11 plus B21 on the other. And this plot probably could be updated because this is toric hypersurfaces and people have studied other classes, but I am pretty sure through the last time I talked to Philip, the shape of the diagram with more dots is the same. So there's obviously structure in the pattern of Calabi-Yaus, and that structure in the available numbers of hypers and numbers of vectors that come out of M-theory compactified on Calabi-Yau. And where does this structure come from? Well, you know, from this point of view of the low energy argument, maybe everything outside of that shield is, you know, the swampland in Kummerman's term, and there is some clear argument for quantum gravity. So now you have to reproduce this funny diagram, the shield. Well, it could be. That'd be a huge clue about the type of argument you're looking for. Okay, or it could be that, well, that figure's a fake, you know, we just looked at this subclass of the Clavielles, you know, but again, there's some evidence that that figure has some reality to it. Another way that it could be a fake, of course, is that M-theory and Clavielle is just one class of things, and we really believe there are lots of other non-geometric or quasi-geometric constructions, so maybe the shape we're looking for is different. Yeah. You know, so, but I think that that figure really should be a clue. Again, you know, there's enough evidence to at least take it seriously and try to explain it from some low energy argument. Okay. So now there is an interesting simple. Okay. It looks simple, but it's certainly, you know, not simple enough for us. Now here's a simpler claim. Okay. So that was the Clavielle threefolds in the story with supersymmetry. Now you can make a much simpler statement if you forget about supersymmetry. And in fact, you forget about, you know, most of what you know, and you just restrict yourself to putting a topological six manifold as the extra dimensions. And then these are actually classified, believe it or not. You know, so there's various other topological data. There were the Betti numbers I mentioned. We're going to set things like, you know, simply connected. And, you know, then there's Stiefel-Whitney classes, a few, you know, Z2s. There's the Pontryagin number, like C2 in the Clavielle. And then the main interesting piece of data is this cubic intersection form, which again will probably be familiar to people. It's topological. It's the same one you talk about in the original Yukawa coupling discussion. And there are a few fairly simple to you know, satisfy constraints on this data, and really, you know, almost linear constraints. And then, according to old work of Wall, okay, you've proven using surgery theory, this is it. This is the classification of the six manifolds, and simply connected. And so the right. And so how do you prove it? Well, you really just kind of construct, because it's topological, things are very flexible. You construct pairs of three cycles that intersect each other once. You construct some configuration of two cycles, you know, to kind of realize this thing. And you kind of, you know, argue that it can all be deformed and, you know, into each other, so that any such construction is equivalent. That's right. Then you would have to. That's right. Well, that's of course fundamentally unclassifiable, actually, in about four dimensions. Yeah. So that's right. You would, I think, to really use this physically, which is now what I'm going to say, you would want some physical argument that corresponds exactly, it picks out the simply connected ones. But there's a worse problem with this, which I'm coming to. But in any case, you can ask, where does this data come from? And so, for example, the cubic intersection form must be something topological because it's quantized, and in fact it is. There's a quantized coefficient in front of the five-dimensional Chern-Simons form. So just as in the talk yesterday with the mixed kinetic terms, it's because these are generically all U1s, you can have this mixed Chern-Simons form. So you read off the cubic intersection form from that. And so there's a string universality. You know, so from one point of view, it was very easy. Now, of course, it's a very weak one because you know, we have no clue that you can solve Einstein equations on, you know, most of these manifolds, and probably you can't. You know, so there's certainly not many, you know, not many sense comparable to Waddy's conjecture about string vacua. Okay, but on the other hand, it suggests a different way to think about it, which is that what's so special about a vacuum? Well, again, you know, it's what we would like to describe our world, but in the larger space of possibilities within string theory, these are just the things that tend to sit there for a long time, and in fact, not even forever. You know, we accept metastable vacua. And so what's so fundamentally different from that in some time-dependent thing that might just start, you know, moving or flowing someplace? Well, they're all part of the same big configuration space. And I think it's quite reasonable if I were to think that that has a simple description, at least the configuration space in which you set the problem. And of course, we don't even know the answer to that in general. So that's the kind of universality we're talking about here. And then once we have an answer to that question, we can go on and say, well, you know, what is the actual dynamics on that space? You know, what are the stable things, the fixed points? Where do things flow to? And of course, that would be very interesting for cosmology and other applications as well. Okay, so now, of course, the barrier to thinking about this is that almost all of that space is not supersymmetric. And of course, if we now go out and talk about things that don't even solve the Einstein equation, what do you work with? Almost every physics paper starts by writing down the Einstein equation or citing some paper which did. So how do you actually start? And well, that's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the. Yeah. Well, that would be another talk. If you want to hear another talk, I can tell you about the space of 2D field theories. And my general answer to this question would be that although these things all sit in a much bigger picture, the smaller picture had its realm of validity, and you can try to answer the question in those realms. So for geometric, for 2D field theory, and then moving on to the, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Everything solves Einstein's equations. Right. Yeah, that's right. You just have to check that you can solve the constraint, and I will show that. Yeah, so there's a constraint on the initial value data, and then once you satisfy it, yeah, everything solves Einstein's equations. So from that point of view, this was the string universality. You know, they all do come. Yeah, that's right. That has structure too. The full supergravity equations, the stringy corrections. Again, yeah, we know how to elaborate to some extent in that direction. But for my point, I can say Einstein equations. Okay, so here are various questions about this. Okay, so one very standard question. One's afraid of non-supersymmetric compactifications because here be dragons. The map says, well, maybe there are tachyons there, who knows? And again, we don't think all these manifolds produce vacua. Is there some simpler a priori question? Okay, can we understand as a simple dynamics slow roll inflation, in the regimes where that makes sense on this landscape? And then that brings us to maybe one of the more profitable questions: is there some effective potential that governs the problem, is a functional on the whole landscape, and its critical points are vacua, and what's minima are vacua really, and then slow roll inflation would be gradient descent in that potential. Okay, so of course this effective potential approach also has the great advantage that you don't need to solve Einstein's equations. It's much simpler to just write down an effective potential function of moduli and add various terms. And to the extent that this argument is right, it's simpler and it's more powerful. Okay, so here's one of the examples, which I happen to work on, but due to Giddings, Kashrou, Polchinski, this 2B string where you can understand the structure of the three-form fluxes on the Calabi-Yau through supergravity and a superpotential. Okay, so that's, again, technical development of the effective potential. Can you calculate it better and better in more situations to more accuracy? But of course, there's also this more conceptual question, actually, is there an effective potential? Okay, and of course, the basic argument that there is not is that it's an off-shell quantity. And again, early in string textbooks, one tends to see the statement that string theory only defines on-shell quantities. And certainly this is the off-shell quantity that you would like to think about. And then there are many more specific objections, and again, I'll cite Tom Banks especially. And maybe one of the most compelling is that from the point of view of the effective potential, well, Minkowski, de Sitter, anti-de Sitter, it's just adjusting a coefficient. You can calculate and say, I found de Sitter vacuum, but in fact, maybe there's a correction that makes it anti-de Sitter or something else. And a small correction can push one to the other. Now, from some other points of view, such as gauge gravity duality, these things are just totally different. There's no way you would confuse a dual theory to an ADS, which is a conformal field theory that we would know how to work with the dual theory to DS, which if you can work with it, I encourage you to publish straight away because that's a famous unsolved problem. So, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that argument has been criticized as well by Tom. So we could again devote a talk to this. So let's not debate Tom's objections, but we'll move to something else. Okay, so now how do you answer these questions? And that's right. So the well-founded objections are based on these things like gravity is different, gauge gravity duality is different, and so forth. Things that don't immediately test known physics.
So the breakdown of the standard picture has to be an expansion, something over n planar.
I would say so. Yeah, if you can think about it in that way at all. Again, it can make sense as an expansion to all orders, but then conceptually, there's some defect in one's thinking. May not be useful for all. Yeah, that's right. Now, certainly, if you're talking about whatever replaces inflation up near the Planck scale, I would certainly not try to think of it as slow roll inflation or an ineffective potential. So at that point, it's certainly well taken. Okay, so anyways, here's the minimal question. Can we find some energy functional which is a functional of the fields on a given manifold? So we're working on describing supergravity or supergravity plus Cherny corrections and vacua in that regime. Okay, so that the critical points are the compactifications and the minima are vacua. Okay, and of course we would like it if the value at the minimum was the cosmological constant, so we could use it in the four-dimensional Einstein equation. Okay, so given that you're starting with supergravity equations, that's certainly a well-posed question. And basically, you look at the four-dimensional part of the higher-dimensional Einstein equations, and there it is, V sitting there, and you can look at any term you like, such as the R00, and read off to V. And so this was first done, to my knowledge, by Steve and Maharana, and I'm going to quote their results and then move on to criticize and try to fix my criticisms. Okay, so here's a generic action, higher dimensional Einstein, higher dimensional gauge fields. Here's a warped metric ansatz with eta for me in this talk represents any of the maximally symmetric metrics. This is the internal metric, and now we've got a warp factor A, which depends on the coordinate y, where you are in the internal manifold. Okay, then you substitute, and you read off the 0,0 component of the Einstein equation. So you get this differential thing in terms of A. You get the curvature. And so this is certainly an equation which must be satisfied. So the main kind of potential pitfall in this is that you may be tempted to start simplifying the problem by using equations of motion. And if you're deriving an effective potential, you should never do this. You will definitely change the value of the potential. You often change the results. So you must never use equations of motion, with this one exception that the zero mu components of the Einstein equation are constraint equations. Again, to make a long story short, it's like Gauss's law in Maxwell theory. These are equations of motion that don't have time derivatives. You must impose them on the initial data, and then they are conserved by the time evolution. And so the theory really only makes sense if you impose that as a constraint everywhere. And so that one you can impose, that one, but nothing else really. Okay, so we've got that equation, and that in principle determines A. So then by multiplying with the suitable factor, we can cook up AV, which will be the source of the standard four-dimensional Einstein equation. There is a warped volume which contains the, this is the relation between the four-dimensional Newton constant and the volume of the extra dimensions modified by the warping, exactly the e to the 2a's and e to the minus 2a's and the ansatz. And so here then is an expression for an effective potential. Okay, so I completely agree with this, but I would say if you try to use it, you will not be satisfied. Okay, and it has a few problems. Okay, so one which is relatively minor, but again will hit you, is that the expression that we gave for the potential clearly depends on the warp factor A, but the expression that determines A depends on the potential V. So you have a kind of a coupled system of equations. And so then you can say, well, you know, there's a coupled system of equations. You know, we solve those for breakfast, no problem. But then the issue is that it's not linear. Okay, these are quadratic and even higher order equations. So you don't know how many solutions they have. It might have no solution. It might have many solutions. It's this very fundamental part of the problem. And so you don't know, is the potential defined? You know, does it have many definitions? Okay, so that's already an issue. Okay, but then there's a much worse issue, which is that the potential, it appears not to be bounded below. Okay, and why is that? Okay, well, let's look at the, it's supposed to be a functional on the fields on the internal manifold, the metric, the rest of it. Let's do a conformal transformation on the internal metric. Okay, so then you can look up in the textbook the transformation law of the scalar curvature, which sat in that potential minus r, and it transforms basically to minus r minus grad b squared. So it's what you would expect. It's a, you know, spatial gradient, but it comes with the wrong sign. And these are standard sign conventions. That's a minus sign. And in fact, it's very bad because the shorter a wavelength fluctuation you make, the more negative it gets. So this is not some sort of, you know, rolling down a potential that you have to stabilize. This is an instability at all length scales and basically doesn't make sense. Okay, so that's only apparent because, of course, we're not instructed just to plug that curvature r into the, you know, into the integral and integrate. We're instructed to solve the constraint equation for the work factor A in terms of the field. Okay, and so there definitely is another term back there that could compensate that negative energy. And in fact, there would be some a priori reasons to think this, because this is really very analogous to the positive energy theorem in you know, traditional classical general relativity. So you have really the same problem in 3 plus 1. You have a conformal factor of 3 dimensions. You can send the energy arbitrarily, the potential energy can become arbitrarily negative in some region, and so you wonder, why is the energy bounded below at all? And physically, of course, it's the attractive nature of gravity that is, you know, telling you that, yes, that's a sensible thing. But the claim of the positive energy theorem is that if you satisfy this Hamiltonian constraint, and if you have asymptotically flat space-time, then the total energy will be non-negative, zero only from Minkowski. So it's clearly some version of that that is going to be called on here to solve this problem. On the other hand, we can't call on their Shen Yao and so forth, Shen Yao, to solve this, because we don't want just one asymptotically flat. We would like to talk about de Sitter and anti-de Sitter and so forth. And there actually is later work doing it for anti-de Sitter, but a known anti-de Sitter. So as to say, if you knew the anti-de Sitter curvature, you know, equivalent to the cosmological constant is some, you know, minus x, then it's bounded below. But from our present point of view, that's circular. We're trying to compute the potential and find out what are the allowed values of the cosmological constant. Okay, so rather, you know, there's this question from the potential. It has a clear definition. Is it bounded below? Okay, so now I did not actually know about Steve's work, but I should have. And on the other hand, it may have been fortunate, because after fooling around with various Einsatzes, I settled on a different one, which just puts the work factor in front of the space-time. You know, I'll use little d occasionally, but we'll say 4 dimensions, and does not put the work factor there. And you'll see, you'll start to see the advantages of that. Okay, so it's just a change of conventions. You know, I'm allowing changing the conformal factor here, so I've mixed those things up in a slightly different way. Okay, so now we'll substitute that. And then there's a very useful change of variables you can make, which is just this. The function u is e to the, in our case, you know, 4 dimensions, 4a over 2. Okay, so we'll write it in terms of that u. Okay, and this is what you get when you make that substitution in the action. You get, this is the action. Okay, so action has positive scalar curvature in the internal manifold. It's going to be turned into minus the potential. Has a gradient term, has the rest of the action, has the Einstein term with the, you know, different you know, exponent for the warp factor because of the weight of the d-dimensional curvature. But everything which came from energy in the internal manifold comes with this u squared, u squared, u squared, even this was greater than u squared. And there's a very simple reason for that, which is that in my definitions, u squared is the volume factor in space-time. And if this is, you know, energy density, it had better scale with the volume in space-time, you know, lives linearly. Okay, so you know, again, just simple physics makes every other term in the action come with a u squared. Okay, and then another advantage, again, you know, minor, but you know, helps think a little bit. The Hamiltonian constraint was the 0-0 component. That just comes from varying a. Okay, so now we just have to vary. It's equivalent to vary u. Okay. Okay, so now you might go on and say, well, you know, here it is, you know, here's the four-dimensional Einstein term, so the rest of it must be minus the potential. But that would not be right, and you can see that either by detailed calculation, which is, so one argument is that, in fact, here's the Einstein equation in the internal dimensions, and it involves, you know, the usual stuff, but in particular, it includes Rd. Okay, so we're supposed to be getting equations in the internal dimensions by varying this potential just as a function of the fields in the extra dimensions. So how can you ever get an RD? You know, so you won't get it if you do it with that. Okay, so what you do, you could try adding the RD, but that doesn't really make sense because it's already there. Okay, and then there's a related problem to this, which is that, in fact, you didn't want to impose ds by d equals 0 because that includes the whole, say, 10-dimensional Hamiltonian constraint. It includes the 4-dimensional Hamiltonian constraint. What we're trying to do is derive an effective 4-dimensional theory where you then go on and use it the same way you would Einstein matter theory. So at that's the point where you should be imposing that Hamiltonian constraint. You should not impose the 4-dimensional one in advance. So you have to split it in two pieces, the constraint, and not solve the zero mode part. And you can do that basically by putting in an undetermined parameter to soak that up. Okay, and so you can then argue that this is going to solve both problems at once. And finally, okay, so now it's just kind of, you know, so far reproducing, you know, the desired equations. But there's something nice about this, which is that I put in the C here, the undetermined parameter, to be the RD source in the internal Einstein equation. But if I add one more term, I can make the combination of this and minus C over GN makes C a Lagrange multiplier, which exactly puts me into Einstein frame. So this was the condition that this warped volume that determines the Newton constant be fixed. So I'm going to just fix the GN, you know, it's 1 or it's whatever Newton constant is, and I fix it at the start, and now I'm going to enforce that with a Lagrange multiplier. Okay, and then that's basically the you know, simplest prescription for this potential. And there's a simpler way of, if you want to check it for yourself, all you're really doing is a Legendre transform from the action function of RD, which was, you know, a four-dimensional thing we didn't want to fix. The prefactor is exactly this 1 over, you know, G Newton. So we're doing a Legendre transform from RD to G Newton to work at fixed G Newton. So that somewhat complicated discussion just amounts to that, but shows that, in fact, you do reproduce all the equations. Okay, so this is the effective potential in these conventions and variables. You have a local energy density. It had the scalar, minus the scalar curvature. It's got the plus energies from matter. Comes with this u squared warping. Has a minus kinetic term, but that's not so bad because the u is going to get set by the constraint equation, and now we can set the whole constraint equation because we've got the C around, and then we've got the Newton constant fixed by Lagrange multiplier. Okay, so this you can check is just equivalent to the higher dimensional equations under the symmetry Einstein. So there's no doubt this is the effective potential. Okay, so here's the case D equals 4, and here's where something kind of fortuitous happens. So we had this more universal expression with the 2 minus 4 over d. So you can see in exactly d equals 4, this becomes linear. So when you vary u, you get just a constant source. So the equation that determines u, this constraint equation, is just a linear inhomogeneous equation, really just a Schrodinger equation with a source. Okay, so u is like a wave function. Here's the, you know, minus d squared of the Schrodinger. And the thing which plays the role of a potential is minus the local energy density. Okay, and then that's got this constant source. Okay, but now you can say, well, here's now we come back to this problem. How do you know what C is? You wrote an equation that depends on C. Okay, but since this equation is linear, okay, you can solve it up to the scale of C. You know, you can say C is 1, find a solution, and then whatever C is, you just rescale the solution. So that linearity is really essential in arguing that there's a unique solution. So when you use it, you would use it the other way around. You would find, you know, solve this equation, determine the normalization of U that puts you into the Einstein frame, again, as a function of the field and whatever, and then use that to determine the C. You know, so it really has a unique solution in this formulation. Okay, so the warp factor satisfies something like the Schrodinger equation. You know, it's a classical part of general relativity, but it's very nice because we all know how to analyze the Schrodinger equation, and we have a lot of intuition for it. And I can just write down the formal solution. I can find a set of eigenfunctions with eigenvalues lambda I, and then that's the standard Green's function solution. The source gets integrated, and I sum over the modes. So that's the general solution for the warp factor. And of course, in different regimes, you can simplify. So there's, of course, you know, a regime where you can neglect the warp factor. There's a somewhat better regime where the V is basically very large and positive. So there's like, you know, deforming ADS across, cross sphere or whatever, you get something where the V is not constant but uniformly kind of large. This V is then negative, and no, positive. And then you can just drop the derivative, and the U is approximately 1 over this V, and you get the leading corrections. Okay, but then there's a very different regime, which would have been what you would do if you were actually, if you knew a priori that you were in Minkowski space, so the C was 0. More generally, if the C is sufficiently small, then you can show that this ground state has lambda approximately C, and it dominates in the sum. And so U is approximately proportional to the ground state of the Schrodinger equation. And then that's a nice solution, too, because the ground state, we have a lot of intuition. And the ground state, of course, is known to be positive definite. You know, it's a function of a definite sign. U was the exponential of the warp factor, so it has to be positive definite. Okay, and so then there are a number of things you can learn at this level. And one of the main ones is that suppose you have a class of constructions where you say you start with ADS and you start putting things into uplift it to DS, as people in this room have proposed and worked on, and I've worked on. And then you may get this question, well, how do I know, as I turn on this uplifting parameter, maybe my ADS vacuum just falls apart and some bad thing happens before I get to DS. Okay, and I didn't write it out because it's more or less an exercise. Okay, what you can do is just add a constant to the V, and it just shifts up all the energy levels. Okay, so this is minus the energy, so actually what it's going to do is shift down the Schrodinger energy levels. So you could have started with the ground state, and now it could have been slightly above, that would be ADS, and then it moves through 0. And although the series solution, you say, eigenvalues moving through 0, once you're at the ground state, the C and the lambda just cancel. So there's nothing singular about moving through 0 in this equation. So you can continue straight from ADS to DS. You know, you prove within supergravity there is no problem in doing that. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with you. And on the other hand, we are obliged to respond to the skeptics, and I hope this will be a convincing response, again, at this level of supergravity. Okay, so now that's an interesting analysis, not just because it shows you can get to DS, but it shows the limit of how far you can go, because as you keep pushing up the vacuum energy, pushing down this V, eventually a second eigenvalue will cross 0. So here was this lambda, here's 0, here is the ADS spectrum, this was this ground state, starts moving down, that's okay to get DS. But eventually, the next excited state will move to 0, and then that will dominate. That'll be resonant, that will dominate the solution. And then at that point, you know something went wrong, because the first excited state wave function is never positive definite. It always has nodes, but this is supposed to be e to the 2a, so it cannot be. A is not positive anymore. So definitely your solution broke down before you got to that point. So this is exactly the limit of going off into DS in this uplifting way, starting from ADS. It doesn't necessarily speak about cosmology and rolling down among DS. It's more of a technical result. Okay, so now let me answer this question. Why is the effective potential bounded below? Okay, so what was the problem? Well, we saw from calculation that by varying the conformal factor, we can make the scalar curvature arbitrarily positive in some region, and that produces an arbitrarily negative contribution to integral of minus the scalar curvature. Okay, but now what we're instructed to do is compute the warp factor using the Schrodinger-like equation with a potential which is R minus other stuff. So as you crank up the curvature in this region, as you keep getting more and more negative energy density, the potential will become more and more positive, and of course the wave function will start to be suppressed there. Right? So as the potential goes arbitrarily positive, the wave function will die exponentially there. And then you can just check in various approximations that that exponential suppression is always larger than the energy density you're putting in, and the warped energy density necessarily will go to zero. So the answer is that the reason that you have this not positive but bounded below energy theorem, so we know we can get ADS to say, is that within a conformal class there's some lower bound to the energy, and it's because if you try to push it more negative than that, that energy will always get warped away. Okay, so that's again, very explicit picture both of warping in this situation and how you glue together the, say, the IR where the warp factor is important to some bulk or UV where the warp factor is order one and so forth. You can, in principle, do it by solving a linear equation. Okay, so now you have to ask, of course, we have this space of possibilities to span over. So which one does minimize the conformal factor? And the basic statement is that moving around in the space, not always, but will tend to lower the energy. Now, if you have supersymmetry, then you know that was the minimum. The general arguments are correct. That first order equation for supersymmetry determines the conformal factor, and so that's what's relied on in the existing work. But if it's a more general non-supersymmetric background, it's not clear that there's any direct analog of that argument, and you should just solve the equation for the conformal factor. And it's now one linear equation for the warp factor and one nonlinear equation for the conformal factor. So it's nonlinear. It's not totally obvious what happens in general. If you look at the leading correction, that's quadratic in these sources, like these energy densities, and that can actually go either way. There are terms of difference on it. And you can say various things about it, which is work in progress to try to get some understanding of when that's important and how much it pushes you. Another work in progress is the kind of straightforward generalization to time dependence, where we're just going to assume an FRW type of space-time. So instead of maximal symmetry, we're going to allow things to depend on one time coordinate, and then this will be one of the homogeneous spatial metrics. So that's doable, but again, one wants to get the equations in the simplest possible form to really see what's going on. But I have, I think, well, I've certainly convinced myself, but there's no paper yet, so that shows something, that the slow roll inflationary regime of this can, to some extent, be understood in terms of that potential. It's clear that there are kinetic and other corrections, but that potential has the basic structure. But then there's a paradox, which is that if you vary the scalar curvature term, of course, you would, just like varying the Einstein action, you get Rij minus a half Gijr. And that doesn't make sense as a flow. Okay, and in fact, there's a correct answer, which is what the mathematicians study, which is the Ricci flow. So this is the sensible flow on metrics, which looks anything like gradient descent in some potential, but it's not obviously gradient descent, and that's again related to this conformal factor problem. You don't do something about the conformal factor problem, problem's just totally unstable. But if you do the right thing, which involves putting in both the indefinite kinetic term for the metric and the Hamiltonian constraint, then this is the dominant piece in this, again, in this very particular slow roll situation. And so this gives a kind of more geometrical picture of slow roll inflation in the supergravity regime, which might lead to new models, and I think will lead to, again, connecting up at least this part of the landscape in a better way. Yeah, I'm assuming the slow roll in four dimensions, and then, using that there, yeah. Of course, you can derive the conditions, the analogs of epsilon and eta and so forth in these geometric terms. Yeah. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Any more questions for Mike?
Constant. Right.
I take this, I mean, the population breakdown is sort of point when it becomes kind of true, but if you just work with these equations, doesn't it happen when it becomes?
Well, there's definitely a regime, where, you know, constant is a good approximation, and continue, and there's another, yeah.
That's below the potential, if I use here and function,
right.
Does it go off to minus infinity at the level of these equations?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have to, that's right. There's a tension between saying that you can ignore the work factor and saying that there's this possibility of energy running away like that. And I think the answer is that, I'm not sure because the equation is nonlinear. I think if you get, you know, again, you know, the linearized equation for the conformal factor to be stable, you know, then, you know, then locally, that usually implies to nonlinear stability. And, I mean, you can, again, there's a very definite equation that you can look at in an example. I'm just not sure if there's an absolutely general claim, so I'm just saying the usual thing you would say. So, in an example, you could show either that there is an instability to the conformal factor or they're not. And I would just say, again, why this intuition that non-supersymmetric vacua have tachyons? Well, to the extent that there's anything beyond, here be dragons on a map, I would say it's this. The conformal factor is naturally tachyonic. So you should expand around the right value to avoid that.
Steve?
Do you think there's some, basically a change of variables to go from the potential to the bonding to the one
that we Oh, yeah, definitely. No, it's right. No, it's a change. It's a change of variables. My point is rather that to use it, you have to be able to answer basic questions like, is it bounded below? Find a place where it's bounded below. And so I've made progress there. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Not a question. All right, RIJ is not necessarily that adjusted for the problem study and the science in general.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So how's one supposed to interpret that in terms of flow dynamics?
Well, where it's positive, no, that's okay. I mean, flow down a potential can go either direction, right? It just depends how the potential slopes, right? I mean, so that's, I mean.
I'm trying to think in terms of inflation, we wouldn't expect it to be fine. We know that we are terminal in science.
Well, I mean, the basic version of what you're saying is that this is going to lead to a problem, this stuff in the internal manifold for inflation, because obviously, this is typically coming from a potential with a slope. It can either make the space blow up or collapse, and you knew you had to stabilize the global volume module, and this is telling you that you sort of have to do it at every point. And then the stabilization, to the extent that the answer is this, which like you say, is just kind of a simplification, it would be the square of this, that you're trying to make small. So, yeah.
Just to return to the question earlier, for the special case where these things are related to sigma model, does this potential become a natural object on the face of the infinite?
Well, that's an excellent question. So that was discussed, a related question was discussed by Seitlin, of course, who for a long time worked on the idea that the beta functions come from a potential. And of course, my discussion relied on the fact that there were extra dimensions in a warp factor and certain aspects of GR. So to the extent you can see those from the sigma model, the answer must be yes. But I'm not quite sure they've been seen in those terms.
Something like C?
Well, again, it's interesting to compare this discussion with Seitlin. It's only something like C. Now, the basic problem with this gradient flow thing is that, of course, you can get this if you make gradient flow in an indefinite metric, and that's what you get in the sigma model. And then the naive definition flows from C equals 0 to C equals 0. So, yeah. So it's sort of, it's not what you wanted, let's put it that way. And this one is better than that.
Okay, so let's thank Michael again.